That would be lovely. But I also can be so many amendments. So it's interesting to get all
I just, the only one that I have been kind of very
you'll get
well
slipped.
about is my resolution to get slipped.
Oh, thank you.
That was conveyed. I said that.
Did you do that on the list?
No, we had
Oh,
all
okay. I can
there
try that.
isn't.
Daniel Auroquois.
Here.
Before. Amira Afpab. Sanya Agarwal.
Here.
Jay Anand.
Here.
Lydia Bloom. Dylan Carson.
Here.
Maishay Kazi.
She's
And Mir Sakic. Colton Cook.
Walking in now.
Daram.
Present.
Grace Dorward. Max Ehrlich.
Here.
Armin Fard.
He's here.
Christian Flournoy. Ezra Galperin.
Here.
Isabella Gale. Lawrence Hahn. Lansh Kakra. Sion Kim.
She's sick.
Catherine Christopa. Yasmin Masood. Ellie Porter. John Purcell.
Here.
Hayden Spector.
Here.
Jocelyn Swaby. Christian Talala. Thor Wagsback. Alexander Walters. Hayden Watkins.
Alex holding a proxy.
Zachary Abu. Eric Yao. Kennedy Young.
Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gaigahono. The Gaigahono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gaigahono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gaigahono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. Please review the February 26th meeting minutes. Representative Galperin.
I motion to approve the meeting minutes.
Their second, their dissent. Seeing none, meeting minutes have been approved. I do not believe that we have March 5th meeting minutes in the packet. I'd like to motion to move presentations up in the agenda to right now above communications by
Second.
unanimous consent.
Second.
Yeah. Is there dissent? Okay, seeing none, presentations are now, and we are pleased to welcome President Kolakoff and Vice President Lombardi to the front.
Right, decorum. Decorum from the audience, please. Okay. All right.
Do you need a mic? Oh, they do need a mic. Thank you, Zach.
Thank you. Is it on?
You're welcome to begin with your remarks, and then we'll move into question and answer.
Great. Thanks, Ura. Thank you, Assembly. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to visit the SA and to engage in another conversation about important and complex issues facing our undergraduate students today. Ryan and I see these visits as a key part of our shared commitment to collaborative, respectful, and productive shared government. Before I say anything else, I want to take a moment to remind everyone about Big Red, Big Impact, the National Marrow Donor Program registration drive that will start tomorrow on campus, continuing through March 20. We had a request earlier this month from a Cornell alum, Juan Uribe, class of 96, whose 15-year-old son, Max, is in urgent need of a stem cell transplant. There's a reason Max's dad reached out to Cornell. Not only are most of our members in the age range that's ideal for stem cell donation, we're also a diverse community, which is exactly what the registry needs. The goal of this drive is not only to find a match for Max, but to improve the chances for all of the patients with blood cancers or other conditions that make stem cell transplant necessary. There will be donor registration stations all over the campus starting tomorrow, and all you need to do is swab your cheek and fill out a form to be added to the registry. It only takes a minute. If you turn out to be a match 90% of the time, you can donate through a blood donation. I can't think of an easier way to help save a life. I hope all of you take the time to register. So there's been much discussion across the assemblies this semester on the campus code and expressive activity policies. I'll say a few words about each of those topics. Regarding our student code of conduct and procedures, we are now in the midst of our annual review process. Our code has now been in use for 5 years. We plan to revisit it every year to ensure that it remains clear, accessible, and aligned with university values and our legal obligations. The Code and Procedures Review Committee shared its recommended revisions with the community this past Monday. After a thoughtful review process that sought input from across our campus community, including all of our shared governance bodies, we're now in a 6-week public comment period, which will end on April 20. Anyone who has input to share on the proposed revisions can do that online. You can also view a line-by-line comparison that shows exactly what changes are being proposed. The committee will make any revisions necessary after reviewing the feedback they receive and submit those revisions to VP Lombardi, who will share his recommendations with me. I will adopt the final revisions and provide notice to the Board of Trustees before the revised code goes into effect on July 1. Regarding expressive activity, I am really happy to say that unlike last year, campus protests have observed the thoughtfully crafted expressive activity guidelines, which were updated last year. As many of you will remember, that update involved extensive community input, including input from the Student Assembly, and nearly 500 written responses to the draft report and policy. No policy is going to be perfect or satisfy everyone, but I believe we have achieved an effective policy that preserves individual rights of free expression while providing clear time, place, and manner restrictions that protect university activities. Have some of these protests been unpleasant for some people in our community? They have. But unpleasantness is not proscribed by our Constitution. On the contrary, the First Amendment protects our rights to express unpopular and even unpleasant views. because by doing so, it protects our ability to live in a democracy. The fact that we've had protests at Cornell that adhere to guidelines drawn by our own community is something in which I take deep pride. I am pleased both that in general, our community recognizes why we must tolerate disagreement and protest, and that protesters adhere to limits that respect the rights of everyone in our community. So,
decorum, please. Please, decorum. Thank you.
Before I move on to your questions, I want to respond directly to some of the discussion around the response time from my office to the resolutions that have been transmitted by the various assemblies, and particularly by the student assembly. When an assembly votes on a resolution and transmits it to my office, I expect, and the constituency that elected that assembly has the right to expect, that the assembly members have examined the issue at hand carefully, that they have discussed it thoughtfully, and they have voted on a final resolution that is accurate and balanced and aims to achieve something of value for their constituency. The assembly has the right to expect that their resolution will be carefully considered and thoughtfully discussed by senior leadership, and that it will receive a timely response. All of us can do better here. I am working within my office and cabinet to improve our procedures in responding to resolutions. These responses usually involve research on the underlying issues and considered discussions among senior leadership, which means finding time on short notice across multiple very full schedules. When something is delayed, my office informs the SA president, as has been the longstanding practice, and we strive to keep those delays to a minimum. Last fall, across the assemblies and faculty senate, we received 23 resolutions and a referendum. 14 of these were from the SA. 5 of those items were related to the student code of conduct, with 4 coming right before winter break when the university is closed. Responses were sent on February 2, about 2 weeks after the semester began, and everyone was back on campus. Last spring, the student assembly sent 28 resolutions, 10 of which arrived on the same day. My understanding from the office of the assemblies is that we are expecting another 30 or more resolutions to be transmitted by the SA alone in the coming weeks. When many resolutions are sent together, it becomes extremely challenging to respond to all of them thoughtfully within 30 days. I ask the student assembly to be mindful of this and submit finalized resolutions immediately as they are approved. It is also challenging to respond to resolutions that include inaccurate or mischaracterized information. This can delay our response as we track down the correct information and work to understand the missing context. I ask the student assembly to work more closely with their advisors and campus staff to ensure they have a complete picture of an issue before submitting a resolution. Cornell has a long history of shared governance, dating back to the 1960s. And it's part of our tradition that I value deeply. It's an expression of our commitment to our core values and part of our educational mission. One of the ways we strive to educate capable citizens who go on to contribute meaningfully to a thriving democracy. Productive shared governance requires that we work together productively, in good faith, to identify problems and arrive at solutions. Every shared governance body expects the good faith commitment from me, and I expect it as well. Having said that, I want to take a moment to point out some conduct I have observed this year over the course of our examination and discussion of the student code of conduct. Specifically, the online harassment, targeting, misinformation, and intimidation, both online and in person, that had been directed at Cornell administrators and Cornell faculty who are diligently and faithfully doing what they have been asked to do in accordance with procedures set out through our shared governance procedures. You may disagree with the approach that is being taken. Expressing that disagreement is your right. It is a right that is protected by our policies and firmly within the spirit of shared governance. But shared governance, like our expressive activity policy, and indeed Cornell University itself, is built on a foundation of shared values that demand we treat each other, whatever our differences, with dignity and respect. Every member of this community, students, faculty, and staff, bears the responsibility to not only respect those shared values as individuals, but to uphold them as part of our community. When individuals or campus groups choose intimidation, ad hominem attacks, deliberate misinformation, and personal harassment as the tools with which they attempt to further their goals, it resonates across our community. It corrodes the spirit of cooperation and collaboration that is key to shared governance. It undermines the sense of safety and trust that enable us to work together in good faith. It silences voices and it strikes at the core of who we are as an academic community. As we enter the public comment period on the draft code of conduct, I invite everyone to recognize this as an opportunity for a collective reset of how we engage with each other and use it to model the kind of community we want to be a part of, where every voice can be heard with respect, feedback, and civil disagreement, where we recognize that we are accountable to one another and bear a shared commitment to uphold the principles and the values of our shared governance tradition. With that, I'd be glad to take questions.
We have two pre-submitted questions, so we'll go for one from Representative Carson, one from Representative Galperin. I'll go in alphabetical order, and Representative Carson, you may read your question first. I just emailed it to you so that you have it. Okay, then Representative Galperin can go first, and then Representative Carson.
Dylan, you want me to read it?
We can. That'd be lovely.
Okay. Since the UN Special Rapporteur's message to Cornell regarding alleged human rights violations against international students on campus, has the university made any response to the letter, or does the university plan to make a response of any kind? We have responded to the letter.
Representative Galperin.
I'm wondering where we're standing, where we stand on housing right now. So myself, among others, have dealt with really unpleasant housing situations over the years. Some of the issues include, but they're not limited to, using study rooms as quintuples, forced triples, sextuples, whatever else. Over the last couple of weeks, issues have also come to light surrounding students with disabilities not being told how they can ensure they get housing that meets their needs. All this has been exacerbated by a housing office that, from my experience, is at best apathetic to students' needs. So my question is simple, because I think the answer should be simple. What are we doing about it?
Yeah, thanks, Ezra. A couple things. One, we have substantially overhauled the staff in the housing office over the last couple years and have also added a number of staff. So hopefully getting it to a point where that service can be at a higher quality for you and other students. With the new leadership in place, we're continuing to try to refine our policies to make sure that we're doing a better job. An example of this is we now have SDS as a part of the continuing occupancy process. So they come to all the information sessions, a representative from SDS, so that if there are questions when students are thinking about where they might want to live, those kinds of things, there's an SDS rep present at those information sessions who can answer questions and help troubleshoot for students, those kinds of things. I do think, Ezra, a pain point, I was trying to give you a simple answer. I do think a pain point probably on the SDS piece is for rising juniors who want to stay on campus. I think most of you know we guarantee housing for first and second year students, not for third year students. So second year students get priority that meets the SDS when they become a third year student. Since they're not guaranteed housing, that priority doesn't exist at the same level. So we'll still assign them, but then retroactively have to work with SDS. So I think that's a pain point still that we need to continue to get better on, just in full transparency, that we could keep working to improve.
Thank you.
Representative Ehrlich.
Thank you, President Kolotkoff and Vice President Lombardi, for joining us today. I do want to start I'm glad that we have a large audience here for this. What President Kolikoff mentioned at the start, the stem cell thing, please do review that email. I think, you know, if I disagree with you, President Kolikoff, on many, many things, and I've voiced that before, but if we can save lives, that would be wonderful. So next, I would like to direct both of you, just for very briefly, and I'm not done speaking here, but, you know, maybe take 10 seconds to look at the signs behind you. Students who are not the assembly have followed the policy and want to show you some actual messages. So I'll give you some time. Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time to read those. I want to address what you said about your commitment to shared governance. I've spoken with people who were on this assembly a couple years ago when you were provost, and they've told me point blank, they've in fact quoted you, that you said that you don't like being here and that you didn't want to be here. You can say that those people were lying. I'm just saying that's what they've told me. At multiple
points. By here, you mean here
at, the, at our assembly.
President Kolikoff, if you don't mind, we can. Okay. Sure. Thank you. I hold them to the same standard.
Sure,
it's okay. I would have tried to interrupt to be fair, but I that's what I've heard. And when I ask my question later, you can respond to that. I also want to mention about the expressive activity policy that you mentioned. You gave a great, very nice canned speech about it. But I don't think students feel good about the expressive activity policy. I had tried to help organize something around it, and it was like actually the biggest pain in the butt. So it's bad, and I'll leave it at that. As for the campus code, I don't have a question about that, but I also want to say anything that's not an independent judicial process and anything that keeps emergency suspensions that don't have due process, which they don't right now, is unacceptable, point blank. All right, so on to my question, and don't worry, I'm not ripping anything up this time. The university, as you've discussed, President Kolikoff, is in a poor financial position right now, which is, of course, due to factors mostly out of your control. You rejected our student activity fee and asked us to lower our recommendation back to $424. Honestly, I thought our original number was too high, and I was pushing for it to go down somewhat, not to 424, but to go down. Regardless, we're seeing with student activity fee just one way that students are bearing some of the cost of the financial hardship of the university. You were at the employee assembly the other day telling them how the university plans to save as much money as possible through restructuring. So they're bearing that brunt. And then, of course, all of our community faculty members are bearing the brunt as well. I did a little bit of digging. I saw that President Pollack, when she was here, made something like $1.5 million, and I suspect you make something like that or maybe a little bit more. That data isn't public. The increase in the SAF, for instance, would cost less than half of that salary. I wouldn't suggest that that's the most pressing financial issue of the university, and I wouldn't suggest you should, you know, request that the trustees reduce your salary by half. I don't think that's reasonable, personally, but I am curious. I really am. Will you commit to asking the Board of Trustees to modestly and reasonably reduce your salary as a leader of this university, so that you, just like all of us, are bearing at least a little bit of the brunt of our financial hardships? You know, there are employees, by the way, who are actually being, you know, losing their jobs, right? So from restructuring. So all I'm asking, will you ask the Board of Trustees for a modest, reasonable pay cut?
Well, let me address your first comment. I'm not aware of ever having said to anyone that I don't enjoy coming to the SA. It's not something I would say, or certainly not something that I feel. On your salary issue, you know, we have tried very hard in this period of financial austerity to try and structure our annual increases in a way in which it's quite progressive. So try and focus most of our raises to those individuals at Cornell that make the least amount of money. We did cap the increases for leadership and administration last year, I don't know that we'll do that 2 years in a row, but no, I'm not going to ask the trustees to lower my salary. What we're trying to do is create the most efficient structure for the university that we can, so that we have the financial flexibility to invest in our core missions. The student experience is one of those absolutely core missions we need to invest in. We need to invest in our facilities and our buildings. We just heard housing challenges. There's challenges across this university. And that's really the function of Resilient Cornell. It's not to create any kind of financial pain. It's not to put pressure on any part of our community, but it's trying to do particularly the administrative support systems that we do in the university simply as efficiently as possible.
Representative Massoud.
Thank you both so much for being here, President Koltikoff and VP Lombardi. I have a question regarding the expressive activity policy as well as the student code of conduct. Scott Grants is a CUPD officer who reported most of the student protesters who have been involved mainly in pro-Palestine protests that have been persecuted by our student code of conduct. However, CUPD records show that he has not been present at any of those protests. And the Faculty Senate has claimed that VP Lombardi is the one who told him to report those students. I just want to know what you guys have to say about that, or what any clarification you might be able to provide.
Sure. So, Yasmin, I have to object to your statement that students have been persecuted.
This is...
Decorum, please.
So, students who have infringed on other people's rights peacefully protesting is not preventing other people from speaking or shutting down a career fair.
Excuse me, President Kalkoff, if you don't mind. In accordance with Robert's Rules of Order, non-members can be removed from a meeting if they do not adhere to rules of decorum. So I please ask that side of the room specifically, because that is where most of the noise is coming from, to please wait until public comment to make your statements, unless they are short, very, very quiet, maybe under your breath, and keep it at that. Thank you very much.
So maybe
do not be sexist towards me next time as well. Thank you. Okay, wait, quit that too. Thank you.
So I just have to point out, we've had multiple student protests this year. They've all obeyed or been consistent with time, place, and manner restrictions that we put in place. People have had the ability to state their views. Their views have not been suppressed. They've not been reported or sanctioned in any way for expressing their views. What I distinguish that, and what the expressive activity policy distinguishes, is that activity from activities that prevent other people from speaking or prevent people from attending activities of the university. That's the distinction that we're trying to make. And I'm pleased to see that people have recognized, by and large, that distinction, because we have not had those disruptions this year. Even the recent presentation by Anderle that's great. Even the presentation by Anderle was one in which the individuals that were presenting were allowed to make their presentation. And that I find as an improvement, where we're allowing everyone to speak, we're protecting everyone's rights, and we're not suppressing individuals' views that want to state their views.
And maybe I'll jump in on the question that you asked in reference to me. I'll just say there has been information shared that is inaccurate about me being a complainant or me directing people to be a complainant. There's been one time in the last 5 years when I received a concern from a community member, which I then subsequently passed, as you would expect me to, as a university staff member, I passed on to the police and to OSCCS and asked them to follow their procedures and look into this particular concern, do their investigations. I didn't tell them how it had to go. I didn't tell them what the outcome had to be. That's happened one time. And I do think probably most would expect in a role like mine, that students are going to come to me and share their concerns about something that may have happened on campus, and that I should share that with the appropriate offices to look into that. I wasn't on campus last spring. I was away for the whole semester on sabbatical when some of the things you were referencing took place. So I certainly wasn't a party to the things you suggested.
Executive Vice President Flournoy. Wait, actually, Representative Causey.
Thank you. I wanted to ask, because we have so many people in the audience holding their very obvious signs, and we have so many people who have continuously protested on this campus for issues that are so repetitive at this point. I believe at this point, you know what students feel. You know how we feel about divesting, about ICE, about war criminals. We have students continuously come out here and give you their voice as you talk about protesting. Like, it's okay if they give you their voice. Now, my question for you is, now that I think it's become very clear what students actually feel, one, do you have any intention to actually follow through with what the students are asking you for? And if you don't find it to be realistic in any reason for whatever your opinion is, why? Like, sorry, people are protesting. What are your next steps for what they're protesting?
So it's an excellent question. We have a policy for divestment, and that policy is all the shared governance assemblies. If a single shared governance assembly sends a resolution to the president is required to respond to that and to say why if they reject it or why if they or to accept it. If the shared governance bodies don't agree with the president and there's enough consensus of the community, all the shared governance bodies can pass a resolution for something like divestment that goes bypasses the president, goes directly to the trustees. So what that rule is meant for is to make sure that we have a consensus of our entire community, faculty, staff, and students, before we do something that is of the impact of what you're suggesting. So I encourage this group, if you feel that passionate enough, to follow the policy and go through that divestment policy.
Executive Vice President Flournoy.
So one thing that's been mentioned a lot with the student code of conduct is that, yes, it hasn't been reviewed within the past 5 years, but now it's going to be an annual thing as well. From a lot of the questions we've heard, and obviously from a lot of students, even as someone who did, when I got here as a freshman, was able to work on the expressive activity policy committee, it obviously isn't something that is working to all students' desires. So are you, President Kolakoff, or anyone in the administration willing to make that process annual as well for an annual renewal? And if so, why? If so, why not?
Process for expressive activity?
Yes. Or no, expressive activity or student campus code?
The expressive activity policy, because student code is going to be reviewed annually. Code, so I'm asking
you. Oh, I see. You'd like to see the expressive activity policy.
Yes.
Yes. Christian, that is something that took months and months of effort. I understand that everybody is not happy with that, but that was a consensus that was achieved through a committee of faculty, staff, and students. It was a tough consensus. I understand that certain people in our community don't like the fact that there is accountability for disrupting certain activities at the university. That is something. So the university is required. The university is responsible, and I am responsible as the president of the university to make sure that the university obeys the law. We have Title VI regulations, federal regulations, that require us to appropriately protect everyone in this community. We cannot violate those policies. So, well, I would say that if you shut down a career fair, if you try and shut down a university presentation, you are violating those policies.
Representative Spector.
I first wanted to thank you guys for coming and being willing to answer questions for us. So I have a question on a little bit of a different topic, but I have been hearing from a lot of students involved in research and even some faculty concerned about research funding. And I know we just had this big donation from Duffield, and I was wondering, are there any other potential big donors like that or any other partners that are in the works that might be able to secure funding for these research projects?
Yeah. So The answer is a bit complicated in the sense that we do fundraise for research. We've been fortunate to raise significant funding for research, but the reality is that philanthropy cannot replace the role of the federal government in research universities. I was funded for 35 years by the NIH. If I had depended on philanthropy to fund my lab during that period of time, it would have shut down at various points, would have lost all my resources and all my personnel. So we really need, what we're trying very hard to do is to make sure that we speak to Congress, speak to individuals to try and emphasize the importance of research, importance of what research universities do for the country, and trying to stabilize our funding. We were somewhat successful this year in that the White House budgets that were draconian in terms of research funding were largely overturned, and we had level funding, mostly the NIH and NSF. And we were very successful at preserving our operating costs, our indirect costs for laboratories for research. We're continuing to work on that. I would say the real effort here would be public speaking. We've talked to, you know, patient groups and others to try and join us with Congress to make sure that we continue to support research funding in the U.S.
Representative Agarwal.
Hi, thank you again for coming today. So student mental health has definitely been a major issue here at Cornell, specifically with the high numbers of suicide rates that we've seen these past few years. So what my question is, how have you been working to address these in like afterwards and supporting friends and students affected, but also preventatively so we don't keep seeing these high rates?
Yeah. Thank you for the question, and thank you for your concern about mental health. I agree with you. Any death is one too many for sure, and we've been working really hard over the last 10 years to try and enhance our services. I do want to maybe offer one correction or comment about the suicide rate. There are occasions when you've heard about a student death on campus where the cause of that death is not widely distributed. I know many people might assume that those are self-inflicted or suicides. That is not always the case. It's just the case that there have been a number of medical episodes, and we very much need to honor the family's wishes in those situations about a level of transparency or not. You can imagine that's the hardest thing a family's ever going to experience, hopefully in their life, probably in their life, and we very much want to honor what they want us to share or not share within the community. So if I just wanted to address that because I know that's sometimes a tension point too, and folks get frustrated that we're not more transparent. When we do have a student death, regardless of the cause, the team in the Dean of Students Office always offers what's called a community support meeting. So they have a great staff and student support and advocacy services that help students navigate all kinds of crises. The staff will come out to residence halls, to academic departments, student clubs, and host gatherings after the student has passed, process, do those types of things, and really try to help lean in. That's a very standard practice after any death. One of the challenges, and if you ever, you know, I hope we don't have to have that conversation, but if you ever have a situation where there's a community impacted that maybe we didn't know about, like, so very easy, just ask for a community support meeting. We'd be glad to send, you know, if there's a group, student organization or a building or something like that, to have that kind of support. So that's a lot of what we do. Oftentimes, close friends, roommates, that team will even work with their college to make academic accommodations, other things to help, knowing what a tremendous impact this has on folks. On the preventative and proactive side, I'll mention a couple things. In my tenure at Cornell, which is a little over 10 years, we've increased our mental health budget by 100%. So we've substantially grown our investment in clinical mental health services. And recently, it was just about a year and a half ago, we got a really transformative gift from a family, $20 million. You may have read about this. That's allowing us, we're adding about 10 additional therapists, all of whom are out and about on campus in academic buildings. We have one up in the athletics area, up in the vet college. I'll probably miss some others, but we haven't hired them all yet. We started first phase this past year, and now we'll do the second phase. So we've added additional therapists, and we're also able to start a new well-being coaching program that right now has 25 well-being coaches on campus, and we're going to grow that number to 80. So this is really trying to help students both in the clinical. The well-being coaching is non-clinical, but really help those folks navigate the challenges. But there's always more we can do. I mean, this is a very pressing issue and something we take very, very seriously. And so
I'd welcome additional suggestions or conversations if you'd like to have other suggestions.
I just add to that that, you know, that was a gift that really responded to Ryan's priority for mental health. So it was an area in which the university directed that funding towards an area of extreme interest.
Okay, I had Representative Cook written down next. Wait, can you raise your placards if you'd like to speak, though? I need to write a speaking order.
Hi, President Kolakoff and Vice President Lombardi. Appreciate you guys coming out here. I'm curious to know, just from your guys' perspectives, or what is the actual biggest issue right now currently among the Cornell community, and how are we going about fixing that issue?
Well, that's a tough one because we have a lot of issues. But I would say right now, you know, we've come through a difficult period with the federal government. This has been a very difficult political period. We have some highly committed political students that have one point of view or another. We have other students that have different points of view. I think this issue of resilient Cornell, there's so much changing right now. We think about international students. International students have been part of Cornell for decades, been a very, very important part of Cornell. When I talk to families now, they're having second thoughts about sending their kids to the U.S. and to places like Cornell because they can't get visas. You know, that's at risk. They can't get internships if they aren't eligible for visas. There's all this press about what's going on our streets and on our campuses. That's one example where we have to think carefully about, you know, is Cornell going to remain the place that's a magnet for people from around the world? So one of the things that this resilient Cornell is doing is really trying to generate the financial flexibility of the university to be able to invest in our core academic missions, research, education, the educational experience, our impact around the world, to make sure that we stay as strong as we have been in the past. That to me is the goal that I want to try and achieve over the next few years, to make sure that Cornell weathers these changes in a way that keeps it strong. Thank you for the question.
Mine's a little simpler. He's the president, I'm not. I think a lot about building community on this campus, and that, you know, we have work to do in that space. And I've talked to a lot of students who feel that challenge and feel like we need to figure out a way to do a better job of building community. So that's what I think a lot about, my concern about building community.
Okay, we are at 5:27, so we do really have time for just one more question. I have Representative Carson as next.
Okay, yes. Thank you guys again for coming and speaking with us. I had a question about, you know, so as we all know, we're a land grant university, and you know, it does mean that we a lot of our, you know, a good portion of our endowment comes from the Morrill Act, and you know, a lot of indigenous lands in the Western United States were dispossessed through, and you know, the land from that dispossessed land was used to help to endow the university. And I'm curious if you guys have any thoughts, because in my opinion, I feel like the university as a whole could do more to recognize that through our land acknowledgement, by including, you know, these groups in the Western United States that had their land dispossessed and that we benefited from these lands. And I'm curious if you guys have any thoughts on how we could improve our acknowledgement of benefiting from the Morrill Act.
Yeah, I would say the main way that we can do that, Dylan, is through providing educational opportunities for Native Americans. And we've tried very hard to recruit in areas and make clear to that community Cornell's need blind, meet full need policies, the ability of those individuals to come to Cornell as any person. I will say that, you know, this has been characterized in a way that I think is a little bit unfortunate, in that there was, as part of the Morrill Act, a land grant process where all the states were given certain areas of lands. those lands were not, that was in the 1860s, 1864 was the Morrill Act. Those lands were U.S. lands at that time. Now, they had been Native American lands prior to that, and there are a number of processes, whether through war or treaties, where that land was transferred to the U.S. But that was what is linked here in a way that's completely ahistoric is the Morrill Act and the dispossession. Basically, all of our land was from Native Americans at one time. So, and yes, it is true that Cornell benefited from that land grant more than other universities, largely because Ezra Cornell refused to sell the land at that time and kept the land and provided funds directly to Cornell. And then it was sold over a period of time. Some of it's still owned by Cornell. Yes, we have a significant responsibility as associated with that. I think the best thing that we can do is provide the opportunity for education for as many of those individuals as we can.
Maybe to follow up on his point real quick at the what he just said at the end there is I know the provost recently had a conversation with ACE, the American Indigenous Studies Program. And from that conversation, I know I've been pulled in and a few other folks into a meeting to think about how we can support what the president talked about, like recruiting more students, but also the students who are already here and how we can do a better job of that too. So I know that's something that's active on the minds right now.
Thank you very much. We are past time.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I enjoyed coming and I would enjoy coming back. And if anybody, and if any of you want
to- We'd love to have you.
Sure. Any of you want to have, extend this conversation privately, be glad to be open to that as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, our next point is communications. We have none this week. Nothing on the consent calendar, so we'll move to reports of officers, committees, and liaisons. Representative Ferrala.
Hey, yes, same thing as last couple of weeks, and it's great that we have an audience today. I am the chair of the International Students Committee, the new chair of the International Students Committee. We're looking for members, so you know, we just heard about some issues that international students are facing on campus. If you would like to join, if you have friends that would like to join, please let me know and we can work from there. Thank you.
Director Gillinson.
Hi all. This is a great day to make an announcement like this given today's superb attendance. I'll also make it short because I know we have other things to attend to. Our election registration period for the spring election, which encompasses all positions, so everyone you see up here, minus the freshman and transfer rate, races, those seats will be up in the spring election. That registration period will open next week, Tuesday, March 18th. The period will remain open until the end of March. Registration, similar to last year, will consist of two parts. First, the submission of a completed candidate application form, and second, the completion of petitions. Election rules will be published alongside the start of registration, which will include the exact number of petitions a candidate must receive to be eligible for the ballot. And with that being said, something a little bit different, I would also smile favorably upon, once presentations are over and everything is over, for a motion to move up consideration of the third reading calendar, specifically Resolution 51, so that we can talk about that today. We started this a long time ago. Let's finish it up. Let me know if you have any questions about elections. And yeah, hopefully we get a lot of traction this semester. So thank you.
Representative Sykic.
Representative. Hi, everyone. Thanks to everyone in the audience for coming. And actually, this is a perfect time to make this announcement. I'm trying to revive the Office of the Student Advocate. And as all of you are here, I assume you have a very big interest in advocating for students' rights. So we were supposed to have a meeting earlier this week, but the people that are currently on the committee, due to time conflicts, couldn't have one. But if you're interested in joining a refounding of the Office of the Student Advocate at Cornell, please reach out to me, speak to me after this meeting. We're trying to create a caseworker system where, you know, students help anyone who reaches out understand their rights and navigate through Cornell's bureaucracy and kind of model it off of other student advocacy offices across other universities. So reach out to me afterwards or email me ac2499@cornell.edu. Thanks.
Representative Agarwal.
Hi, everyone. I'm the chair of the Student Health Adversary Committee. So if you have any questions or concerns about student health on campus, we work directly with Cornell Health. Our next meeting is on Wednesday from 4:30 to 5:30 p.m. We'll be meeting with Cornell Health. Right now, our next topic of discussion is looking at increasing access to mental health resources, specifically on North Campus. So looking if we can add more like counselors at like RPCC or Tacton, and then also looking if we can add transportation to Cornell Health.
Representative Bloom.
Hey guys, I'm the chair of the Environmental Committee. We have been pretty active this semester, thankfully. Just a quick like recap of what we talked about last meeting, what we've been up to. Most Fridays we table. You can find us in either probably Mann or Olin. We are working on passing through Resolution 70, which calls on Cornell to ban single-use plastics. I'm kind of excited about that one. We're also taking a look at the Climate Action Plan and seeing how Cornell could revise it. And then we're also still working to get recycling into fraternities, which has had some motion this week, which is good. So yeah, that's kind of the recap from the Environmental Committee. Shout out to Dining Committee also for inviting us to attend one of their meetings. I involved myself in at least like three new sustainability projects, so they're doing some cool work over there.
Representative Ehrlich.
Two things. Number one, Academic Policy Committee is meeting every other week. We yes, is on it. We had our meeting this past weekend. We just put in a new resolution about students being able to reschedule prelims if they have more than 3 in 24 hours. So, you know, we just saw Michael Kolakoff. I'm sure he will reject that, but whatever. And then my other thing, did we all hear that moral act thing he just said? Wait, like that was
Max.
Crazy. That was crazy.
You can keep that for public comment.
Yeah, it is out of order for me to bring it up, but I hope the Sun person heard that because that was crazy insensitive. Crazy insensitive.
Representative Galperin.
Hi, everyone. A couple things. First of all, yeah, thank you to the Environmental Committee for joining the previous Dining Committee meeting. A couple updates from the meeting. The Dining Committee has voted down Resolution 59. Any concerns thereof can be relayed to me. Second, some Passover and Ramadan updates, which I'm going to venture, I guess, are relevant to some people in this room. For those who aren't aware, first of all, I'm sorry for not communicating this before Ramadan started. You should be able to pick up your pre-fast meal at any of the dining halls, at a number of the dining halls. Again, check online for exact information on which one you should be able to pick up your breakfast meal at the beginning of the day. Lastly, Passover hours will be very limited for 104 West as Passover does begin over spring break. Again, hours and full procedure can be found online. I would just want to put it on everyone's radar.
Any further reports of officers, committees, liaisons? Seeing none, no announcements, and we'll move to open microphone. I will now recognize community members who wish to speak at this time. Each recognized community member, wait a second, may speak once for up to 3 minutes. Tonight, public comment will end at 6:30. For the sake of balance and time, the beginning of public comment will be structured so that 5 community members in favor and 5 community members opposed to Resolution 61 may speak in an alternating fashion. Following that approximate 30-minute period, public comments will be recognized in order of appearance. Capiche? Okay, so is the person at the front of... Are you... will be... Again, begin with one person in favor of Resolution 61, one person opposed, one person in favor, one person opposed, favor, opposed, favor, opposed, favor, opposed. Wait, okay.
Yes, point of order.
Recognized. Okay, then you'll be recognized, then I'll start my 30 minutes back and forth with everybody else. Okay, you have 3 minutes. You can sit. I'll gavel once at 30 seconds and twice at 15 seconds remaining.
Okay. Well, thank you for this time. This is actually a perfect segue from Representative, is it Galpin? Galprin, yeah. Is that your name? From what you just Close shared. Enough. My name is Leah. I'm the president of Interfaith Council at Cornell. It is one of the three primary funding boards on campus, including the Club Sports Council and the SAFC. So this is just ICC's response to the reassessing of the Resolution 21 of approving the recommendation for the next 3 years a student activity fee. I'm going to share a presentation. I know I only have a couple minutes. I'm not going to share the whole thing, but basically our response is the new recommendation of $9 per student for the Interfaith Council is not enough to cover the annual allocations for 35 plus orgs we have. And if it doesn't cover the 35 plus orgs that we currently have, then they won't be able to host those events. They won't be able to provide food for Ramadan. And we also, as well as other Passover or religious holiday events. And we also won't be able to fund or host any additional events that have been occurring for the last few years. So I guess just to give you numbers, on this page, we have currently we're at $6.50 per student. With the current number of students, we're only getting 108K. And this past, for this current academic year, we've been needing to allocate $123,000. The deficit of 15K has been covered by the SAFC's leftovers, in which case they actually had quite a bit that they were able to give to us to cover for our annual allocations. On top of that, the proposition, SAF's proposition would only give us 149K. But it won't be it still won't be enough to cover our current orgs that are trying to move up in funding tracks. And the requirements for that have been set by campus activities, not us, as well as orgs moving from SAFC to ICC, because orgs can transfer, as well as the Flex Fund, which helps host a number of events. So we currently have several religious orgs in SAFC that could move to us. So on top of that, if that is the case, if we could propose a small funding cut to SAFC and a reallocation of that budget to ICC, that is all that we ask for in order to cover the current allocations of our religious orgs on campus. Thank you. That is all.
Thank you. We begin our 10 speakers with one pro argument. And again, I'll gavel it once at 30 seconds and twice at 15.
My name is Adriana Vink. I'm co-president of the Progressives at Cornell. I am here today to speak in favor of both Resolution 55 and 61. Resolution 55 seeks to ensure that our university administration does not use its particular institutional platform to propagate the ideas and stances of war criminals. In 2025, the office of the university president, the guy who was just here, sponsored an event labeled Pathways to Peace, hosting Israeli war criminal Zippy Livni, who for many years was not able to step foot in European countries for fear of arrest by prosecutors. This includes canceling trips to the UK and Belgium after receiving summonses from local police. Resolution 61 asks the university to reevaluate its relationship with the Technion Israel Institute of Technology, whom it partners with at Cornell Tech in New York City. Technion has researched and developed weapons for the IDF and private defense companies, such as the D9 bulldozer, drones, smart bombs, surveillance technology, and more, all of which are tested on Palestinians and deployed around the world. I would like to take the remainder of my time to condemn a recent smear campaign against one student assembly member who introduced these resolutions, exercising her right and her duty as a member of this body. This campaign has been orchestrated by a group called End Jewish Hatred, which I will note has absolutely no association with or connection to Cornell or the Cornell student body. One of the founders of End Jewish Hatred, Brooke Goldstein, has said publicly, quote, "There is no such thing as a Palestinian person." She is also a fellow at the Claremont Institute, which is described by the New York Times as the, quote, "nerve center of the American right and the progenitors of Project 2025. And Jewish Hatred is also heavily funded by Miriam Adelson, Trump's number one donor. This is the group opposing these resolutions today and conducting a smear campaign of personal targeted harassment, including attempting to refer someone that you share this space with to the Trump administration to be investigated for introducing student assembly resolutions. If you vote against these resolutions today, you find yourself on the same side as those propping up the Trump fascist regime. Resolution 55 says our university should not use its institutional power to platform war criminals. And Resolution 61 says our university should not be partnered with those who manufacture the tools and weapons needed to enact war crimes. That is what these resolutions before you are about, and that should be the topic of your discussion today. Read the content of the resolutions themselves and vote your conscience.
Good evening. Members of the Student Assembly, many of you have heard from me last week, so I'll keep the introduction brief. I'm Davian Gackman, a former member of the Assembly representing the School of Industrial and Labor Relations. When I served here, the focus of my work was simple, tangible improvements to student life. I worked with colleagues and administrators to bring Narcan, fentanyl, and xylazine testing strips and date rape drug testing kits into on-campus housing. I mention that because I believe the Student Assembly is at its best when it focuses on solving real concrete problems for undergrads. That is why tonight I want to urge members to vote no on Resolution 55 and Resolution 61. Starting off with 61, this resolution asks the undergrad Student Assembly to weigh in on Cornell's institutional partnership with the Technion. Regardless of how anyone personally feels about that partnership, this simply is not within the purview of the undergraduate Student Assembly. That partnership primarily concerns graduate programs, research collaboration, and university-level institutional relationships. Those issues involve the administration, trustees, and graduate governance bodies. The Undergraduate Student Assembly exists to represent undergraduate students and to legislate on matters affecting undergraduate life. When this body begins weighing in on institutional partnerships and graduate-level matters, it moves beyond its mandate and dilutes its ability to advocate effectively for undergraduates. Moreover, when similar resolutions have been passed in this assembly, the administration has not adopted them. Why would this one be any different? This resolution will not tangibly change anything on campus, so why are we wasting our time? Then there's Resolution 55. Resolution 55 moves the assembly into another area that should give members serious pause. Positioning this body as a judge of global political conflict and the legitimacy of speakers invited to campus, the problem with that approach is not just the specific case addressed in the resolution, it is the precedent it creates. Once the Student Assembly begins establishing political or ideological standards for who should be allowed to speak or participate in campus dialogue, it opens a very slippery and dangerous slope. Today it may apply to one issue, tomorrow it could apply to another, and eventually it risks turning this assembly into a body that arbitrates international disputes rather than governing undergraduate affairs. Cornell has historically upheld principles of academic freedom and open inquiry. Universities should be placed where should be places where controversial ideas are debated, challenged, and scrutinized, not places where student legislators attempt to regulate speech through political resolutions. If we begin to regulate speech or institutions based on politics, we do ourselves a disservice. A university education is meant to expose us to differing perspectives, not to shut them down. Growth happens through engagement, not avoidance. There is also a practical consideration. This assembly has limited time, limited political capital, and a real opportunity to improve undergraduate life. Students right now are dealing with housing costs, mental health challenges, financial pressure, and campus safety concerns. When I served here, I saw firsthand how much effort it takes to move even one operational policy forward. Every minute spent on symbolic geopolitical resolutions is a minute not spent addressing the issues affecting Cornell students. Thank you.
Time is up.
All right. Hello, my name is Francis Burns, and I am here to express my strong support for resolutions 55 and 61. I think we've all heard the phrase that with great power comes great responsibility. Cornell is an institution with great power, and with that comes a responsibility to respect principles of international law, to create an environment of mutual respect and safety, and to uphold principles of freedom of speech and diversity of thought. As I stated at our last meeting,
Resolution 55 does not call into question the ability of students, faculty, or student groups to invite a wide range of speakers to our campus, addressing the previous point. Controversy and difference of opinion are unavoidable aspects of intellectual inquiry and something to be celebrated. We should be grateful for the opportunity to regularly hear perspectives very different from our own. Echo chambers are dangerous. They weaken our democracy and the strength of our critical thinking. Resolution 55, however, addresses a simple common sense principle. The university should not alienate students and faculty by inviting individuals who have faced credible accusations of war crimes to our campus. Many of us, myself included, would not accept the university hosting a Russian military official implicated in war crimes or a Qatari official responsible for human rights abuses. That would be a clear violation of the moral responsibility this institution carries. Resolution 55 seeks to communicate to university leadership that such events are unacceptable to the student body and a poor use of our tuition money, which could instead go towards things like expanded fitness facilities or free laundry. Regarding Resolution 61, there is no reason why an Israeli university closely tied to the Israeli military should draw immense donations from bread and butter issues to establish a satellite campus funded entirely by Cornell and its donors, not by Technion. Cornell should not be developing technology that may be used to commit genocide and enforce apartheid. My tax dollars already fund a genocide. My tuition dollars should not do the same. Finally, I want to address something that happened in relation to this resolution. A letter was sent to trustees, administrators, and numerous officials in the Trump administration in an attempt to have the author and the sponsors of this resolution punished for exercising their freedom of speech. This exposed assembly members and vocal students to potential retaliation from an administration with a known record of targeting students for their political beliefs. I have serious concerns about who in this room and on this assembly may have been involved in that effort. Regardless of where anyone stands on the substance of these resolutions, our assembly is a democratic institution. When you threaten assembly members, student groups, and the federal funding of this university by calling on a fascist administration to punish us for expressing our beliefs, you undermine the basic norms that allow this body to function. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Jeffrey Letterman, and I'm a senior here at Cornell. I'm here tonight to speak against resolutions 55 and 61, and to urge every member of the student assembly here to vote them down. My objection is that the resolutions are poorly reasoned, selectively applied, and corrosive to the principles that make a university worth attending. Resolution 55 condemns the administration for inviting Tzipi Livni to speak at a Pathways to Peace event, characterizing her as implicated in war crimes. It cites arrest warrants and investigations, but not a single conviction, not a single formal indictment by any international court. If the standard for barring a speaker from campus is that allegations have been made against them, this assembly is not setting a principled threshold. It is handing a veto to whoever lodges the loudest complaint. And if we cannot hear from participants in real conflicts at an event about peace, we have hollowed out the word education entirely. Peace is built through difficult engagement with people who have wielded power in the very conflicts we hope to resolve. Resolution 61 calls for terminating Cornell's partnership with the Technion on the grounds that its research may contribute to military technologies. Applied consistently, this principle would implicate virtually every major research university in this country and abroad, including Cornell. The resolution offers no framework for why the partnership crosses a line that countless others do not, except that it involves an Israeli institution. That is not a principled standard. It's a selective one. I want to speak directly to that selectivity because it reveals the nature of these resolutions. No university should be in the business of blacklisting speakers or severing academic partnerships on the basis of a political litmus test, full stop. Yet these resolutions do not even attempt a consistent principle. They each name one country, one set of actors, one conflict. What is being proposed is not a serious ethical framework. It's a targeted political campaign dressed in the language of human rights. Universities exist to expose us to perspectives that challenge us, including those we find deeply objectionable. The proper response to speech we disagree with is more speech, more dialogue, more debate. These resolutions choose the opposite path. They ask this institution to close doors rather than open them. I urge you to vote against resolutions 55 and 61, not because the questions they raise don't matter, but because the answers they propose make us smaller and weaker as an institution. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Mina Petrova, and I'm a freshman in Arts and Sciences. I'm here today to speak in favor of both Resolutions 55 and 61. Resolution 55 condemns Cornell's use of its institution to propagate the militarized stances of war criminals and human rights violators. For example, the 2025 Pathways to Peace event hosted a former Israeli foreign minister who a United Nations fact-finding mission and investigations by Amnesty International have determined has violated international humanitarian and human rights law. The administration, and Kotlikoff specifically, their misguided attempt to foster discussion without any critical thinking regarding to ethics and concern for the safety of its students is deplorable. War criminals are not protected under free speech. This resolution is specifically against war criminals on campus, so it's not a slippery slope. It is unsafe to invite a war criminal who was unable to travel to European countries due to warrants out for their arrest. It's unsafe for the students. Perpetrators of genocide and human rights have no place on an institution whose mission is to educate. War criminals have no place in an educational institution. Furthermore, this resolution refers to any war criminal and it makes no distinction based on nationality. It uses the example of Pathways to Peace because one war criminal on campus is one war criminal too many. In addition, Resolution 61 seeks for the university to terminate its partnership with Technion, Israel Institute of Technology. This partnership is harmful, immoral, and unnecessary. Technion has been Israel's primary source of technological manpower, allowing it to commit its horrific genocide against the Palestinian people. And I cannot believe that we still need to argue that it's a genocide. The IDF bombs family residents, hospitals, and bulldozes schools. Why can't you listen to the UN? Because the UN says it's a genocide. Further, Cornell Tech can prosper as an institution without affiliation with Technion. The partnership does not provide much of any financial benefit. It only degrades the moral integrity of Cornell. There are no universities left in Gaza. How can we be content to study in a university that is complicit in the destruction of higher education around the world? I want to be proud of being a Cornell student, but it's hard knowing how complicit this institution is in war crimes and genocide. Thus, I urge the Assembly to pass Resolutions 55 and 61 because voting against them means supporting Cornell's very real ties to genocide.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Louis Gold, and I'm a graduate student in the Department of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology. I'm here to speak to you tonight about Resolution 61. It's important to note that I am president of the Jewish Graduate Student Association. However, I'm only speaking on behalf of myself. While many of the people in this room as undergraduates are not typically direct beneficiaries of Cornell's partnership with the Technion, the partnership is a valuable and important piece of the graduate student experience. The Technion is Israel's Institute of Technology, a world-class research organization, much like Cornell. The Cornell-Technion partnership provides operational support and stimulates groundbreaking research that will have a tangible impact both on campus and around the world. The Technion and the research it supports has created advancements in desalination technologies and engineering techniques that have been widely adopted across the world. Research from the Technion supports all citizens of the world, whether Israeli, Palestinian, or American. From USB drives to early-stage Parkinson's disease treatments, the Technion has created technologies that have changed the world. Even the PDF, the format in which I read Resolution 61, was originally created by Technion students and researchers. Given all of the good the Technion does in the world, I would like to call into question the intention behind Resolution 61. On page 2, lines 51 through 53 mentioned complicity with human rights assaults. While I commend your dedication to human rights and agree that it is a noble cause, I cannot help but question why the Technion partnership is the only one being called out. While Cornell Medicine has a campus in Qatar, Qatar has a long history of documented human rights violations, including modern-day slavery. Qatar regularly practices debt bondage and passport revocation while simultaneously funding Hamas, an internationally recognized terror organization.
How does the Qatari partnership escape criticism while the one with an Israeli institution is singled out for condemnation? What principle is being applied that distinguishes these two cases? Is there a meaningful distinction that justifies this selective criticism? If human rights concerns are truly the guiding standard, they should be applied consistently rather than selectively. Setting aside the selective attention given to human rights concerns, I would be remiss not to mention the venue in which this resolution is being brought. Just as it would be inappropriate for graduate students to interfere with undergraduate student business, it is inappropriate for undergraduate students to interfere with graduate school business. Moreover, those who would be impacted by this the most, graduate students at Cornell Tech, don't even have a seat at the table regarding this decision. I asked the undergraduate student assembly, how would undergrads feel if graduate students at Cornell Tech suddenly endorsed massive changes to the Ithaca campus? Please respect this partnership is not yours to pass judgment on. Let graduate students handle our own affairs. For all these reasons, I ask you to vote against Resolution 61. The content of this resolution is counterproductive, will take away valuable resources and opportunities from graduate students at a time when graduate research opportunities and funding are being threatened, and it is not within the purview of this undergraduate student assembly to comment on. Thank you for your time.
Hello, my name is Savannah Rostad, and I'm a senior in ILR. I'm also a
Can you speak a little closer to the mic, please?
Yeah. Hello, I'm Savannah Rostad, senior in ILR, also a member of Jewish Voice for Peace at Cornell. I'm reading a statement on behalf of my friend Zoe Reisman, because she couldn't be here tonight due to a prelim. So here goes. I want to express my support for both Resolution 55 and Resolution 61. I'm speaking as a Jewish student. Because of that, I want to address directly a claim that supporting these resolutions is somehow anti-Semitic. Criticism of a state, a military, or an institution is not the same thing as hatred of Jews. These resolutions do not target Jewish identity, Jewish students, or Jewish culture. They address institutional relationships and the ethical responsibilities of this university. Conflating those things actually makes it harder to confront real anti-Semitism when it occurs. Conflating Jewish identity with the actions of a genocidal nation state is actively dangerous to Jewish people. When Jewishness is treated as synonymous with the policies of a government, it risks placing responsibility for those policies onto Jews everywhere, including Israelis. Resolution 55 asks a very basic question about academic integrity. Should a university platform individuals implicated in serious human rights abuses and present them as authorities on peace and diplomacy? What? Universities should be places for critical inquiry, not spaces where violence or war crimes are normalized and rehabilitated. Resolution 61 similarly asks whether Cornell's partnerships align with its stated commitments to human rights and ethical research. The concern raised here is about institutional complicity in military technologies and systems of surveillance and control. Universities regularly evaluate partnerships for ethical reasons. This should be no different. As Jews, we were raised with the principle that never again means never again for anyone. That moral framework pushes us to oppose systems of violence, militarization, and apartheid wherever they occur. Supporting these resolutions is not an act against Jewish people. It is an act consistent with deeply held Jewish values of justice and accountability. For those reasons, I strongly urge the assembly to support both resolutions. Thank you for your patience tonight. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jamie. I'm a freshman. Since the 1990s, the Israeli government has shifted increasingly to the far right.
due in large part to unwavering support from the American right. This is why we have seen further encroachment on Palestinian land and attacks against Palestinian communities in recent years. Unfortunately, Israeli liberals have not been the beneficiaries of that same love from the American left. A cornerstone of the Israeli left, much like here in America, is the university system. Leading Israeli magazine writer Ido Conrad called the university system, quote, the last bastion of progressive thought in Israel. Israeli universities are where left-leaning students organize anti-war efforts and spread anti-Netanyahu messaging. Israeli universities are where coexistence is not just a promise, but a reality. At Technion University, for example, 1 in 5 students are Palestinian. So while the American right cozies up to Netanyahu's extremist, far-right ideologically driven base, American liberals are tragically hostile to their Israeli peace-seeking counterparts. So to you, American college students, I say, in order to see an end to violence in Gaza and in the West Bank, you should actually seek to bolster relations with Israeli students who agree with you on the crisis in Gaza. It doesn't make sense to boycott people who are fighting your fight and who have power to sway Israeli politics from within, in the direction you want it to go. As for Resolution 55, Tzipi Livni is not a war criminal because she has not been convicted of war crimes. Please fact check me on that right now. The arrest against her in London was organized by a private group and reversed by the British government. Once again, Tzipi Livni is on your side of this conflict. She's a decorated history in peace negotiations as the lead proponent of the two-state solution during the Annapolis Conference in 2007. So as far-right leaders like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir seek to annex Palestinian villages, let us devote attention to silencing people like them, not peace advocates like Tzipi Livni. Please vote against Resolution 55. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Assembly members. My name is Sam Poole. I'm a Cornell sophomore, electoral chair of the Cornell Young Democratic Socialists of America, and a member of Jewish Voices for Peace at Cornell. First, I'll speak to the matter of YDSA's funding request. 17 of our members attended the winter conference in Chicago, February 20th to 22nd. We discussed how to protect immigrant students from ICE, support student workers, and build an intersectional movement that centers the concerns of marginalized young people. We're requesting funding from Student Assembly to reimburse our members for the cost of this conference, hotels, gas, food, and registration. This funding will support students who would not otherwise have been able to participate and help us continue our work advocating for a campus where everyone feels welcome and fighting for affordability for Cornellians and Ithacans. I'm also here today to discuss two other resolutions before the Assembly, Resolutions 55 and 61. I was disappointed to hear that a part of the Jewish community here at Cornell opposes these resolutions. They believe that either no war crimes have been committed by Israeli officials, contrary to the findings of the United Nations Human Rights Council and the International Criminal Court, or that inviting these individuals is not only part of the acceptable academic discourse, but so vital that any attempt to stop it constitutes anti-Semitism. I'm proud to be a part of the Cornell Jewish community as well, and so it saddens me to hear so many of my fellow Jews try to use our faith and our experiences with persecution to justify bringing people to campus who represent governments actively carrying out unimaginable atrocities. If our university wants to be a place devoted to any person, any study, a place where everyone can feel safe, then inviting speakers to campus who have perpetrated horrific crimes, regardless of their religion or nationality, is directly contrary to that goal. The same principle is why I support Resolution 61. I'm proud that our university is a leader in cutting-edge research and that our students participate in engineering that makes a difference. When Cornell Tech collaborates with Technion Israel on developing sonic weapons that destroy the eardrums of protesters and drone surveillance systems to monitor civilian populations, are we really living up to those ideals? Now, some here today have already argued that this isn't the Student Assembly's concern because Cornell Tech doesn't mostly work with undergraduates. To you, I say this. Does your degree say Cornell University but not Cornell Tech? Can you check a box to ensure that your tuition doesn't fund this collaboration? Everyone wants to feel like their own hands are clean, that there's nothing we can do. The fact is we have a moral responsibility to act. We are part of an institution that collaborates on research implicated in genocide and apartheid. And unless we raise our voices and urge our university to cut ties, then we too are complicit. I urge this assembly to approve the funding for Cornell YDSA and pass Resolution 55 and 61 to uphold our university's values as an inclusive community and a place truly dedicated to research for the common good. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Will, and I'm a freshman student here at Cornell. Like many other people here, I intend to speak to you about resolutions 55 and 61. These resolutions call out the university for a partnership with Technion, an Israeli university, for hosting Tzipi Livni, former Israeli foreign minister, on campus. I'm not here to debate the content of the resolutions, but rather the impact that they will have on our campus. As we have seen time and time again, since October 2023, when Israel is targeted in the media or on a public stage, there are tangible impacts on campus. In fact, on October 12, 2023, 2 full weeks before Israel initiated its war response, an anti-Israel resolution was brought to the assembly floor. Almost immediately afterwards, death threats were directed towards Jewish students in the kosher dining hall on campus. In February 2024, a resolution calling to divest from Israeli institutions was voted on once again in this assembly. Leaving the building that very evening, Jewish students were harassed and intimidated by their peers. During the referendum to divest from Israel later that semester, Jewish students described feeling unsafe and unwelcome on campus. One student reported trying to hide their Jewishness from peers on campus, and another said that they lost friends over it. This is the reality that you are inviting to campus by passing these resolutions. Just last week, students who rose in opposition to the resolutions you are voting on today were heckled, their free speech undermined, by the president of the Cornell Progressives. It is a fact that when Israel is attacked verbally and publicly, Jews around the world and on this campus feel the negative impacts. In my hometown of Toronto, Canada, 3 synagogues have been fired on with guns in just the last 2 weeks. Today, at Detroit's Temple Israel, an anti-Semitic attacker drove their car into the synagogue, which also contains an early childcare center, attempting to harm those inside. Attacks like this are an unfortunate part of life for Jews all around the world, in no small part due to anti-Israel and anti-Semitic rhetoric. Let me ask you this. Does your house of worship need to have armed guards at all times? Do you fear for your safety and that of your family and friends every time you go to pray or be in community? This is the reality for Jews all around the world and on this campus. How are we expected to feel safe when Jews in Australia are shot and murdered for celebrating Hanukkah in public, or when someone threatens to shoot up the kosher dining hall on our campus? Words that target Israel, the world's only Jewish state, also target Jews. At a time when Jewish people around the world are expected to answer for Israel's actions, your words matter, and they actively harm us.
Hello, members of the assembly. My name is Sayuri Pfeiffer. I am the president of Students for Justice in Palestine, and I am here to urge you all to vote yes and pass Resolution 61. I would also like to quickly state that this environment of supposedly every pro-Palestine resolution being brought forward is creating an unsafe condition for Jewish students on campus. I will say that the continued attempt, as demonstrated by the smear campaign against the student assembly member who brought these resolutions forward, shows that there is an oppositional force on this campus who's also creating an unsafe environment. Also for students, such as students in JVP, who were actively doxxed by someone named Zach Sage Fox, who, a member of this assembly, reposted this video, and then CFI invited this person back to campus. So that was actually an example of an oppositional force making student life unsafe for Jewish Voices for Peace members. So I just would like to bring that to people's attention. but I'm here predominantly to ask you all to vote yes and pass Resolution 61. Resolution 61 looks to dissolve our partnership with a university whose research has produced bulldozers that have steamrolled civilians, auditory weapons designed to injure civilians and call protest, and to contribute to the social capital of a genocidal nation. I'm going to quote something from a Nation article that came out when the Cornell Tech partnership with Technion was announced. Technion conducts research and development into military technology that Israel relies on to sustain its occupation of Palestinian land. For example, Technion developed an unmanned D9 bulldozer for the Israeli military, which it used during Operation Castled, which is incidentally the operation that Sipni Livni was a member of the war cabinet for, a war that killed almost 1,400 Palestinians, mostly civilians. Because of the machine's exceptional results, which again was developed at the Technion, Israel is expanding its use of unmanned bulldozers. Their bulldozers have demolished some 27,000 Palestinian homes and properties since 1967. Technion also has partnerships with Israeli arms companies such as Elbit and Rafael. Elbit provides surveillance equipment for the separation wall, such as cameras and drones, while Rafael manufactures missiles that accompany drones and an armor protection system for the IDF. Technion is also a leader in the development of drone technology, which Israel has deployed in occupied territories. The Technion Autonomous Systems Program focuses on researching and developing new unmanned vehicle technology, including drones, and they developed the Stealth UAV, which can fly up to 1,850 miles without refueling and carry 2 1,000-pound smart bombs and operate in the dark under all weather conditions. This, to me, does not sound like a so-called liberal leftist institution that's trying to uphold peace for Palestinian people. This, to me, sounds like an institution that is directly complicit in the continued genocide of Palestinian people. I think it is a gross mischaracterization of the type of research and the type of products that this research institution is directly complicit in creating. And if Cornell wants to uphold its mission of doing the greatest good, it will dissolve this partnership. Thank you.
As a time check, we have 14 minutes left in public comment. So that is about three speakers.
Good evening. My name is Sophia Eliassi, and I'm a freshman undergraduate student at Cornell University. While the sentiment is generally true that graduate students are the most impacted by the relationship between Cornell and Technion, I am one of few undergraduate students who has a strong connection with both of these institutions and cares greatly about maintaining the cross-institutional relationship. I am a member of the Milstein Program in Technology and Humanity, a program that emphasizes interdisciplinary studies and creating world-changing projects sparked by thought across fields. As a scholar in this program, I will soon be involved in an 8-week summer program at the Cornell Tech campus, supported by its makerspaces, resources, and world-class professors, made possible by Technion. Many of the professors and researchers are themselves affiliated with Technion, bringing their vast knowledge with them. My upperclassmen peers have described this program as life-changing, providing them with insightful experiences and the opportunities to develop impactful innovations. Losing this relationship between the main Cornell campus, Cornell Tech, and Technion would create a massive dent in the potential innovation undergraduates can pursue, as resources, collaboration, and interdisciplinary thinking would effectively be slashed. My education and that of my peers in the program would be severely diminished if this resolution were to pass. It is important to note that while the rhetoric in this resolution frames Technion as a weapons manufacturer, it is in fact an institute of technology, much like MIT, Caltech, or Georgia Tech. If those who oppose defense research are so inclined to disconnect from Technion, they may as well make an effort to erase the Duffield College of Engineering and every engineering program in the United States. Technion's biological breakthroughs have saved lives, from biological glue that serves in place of stitches, to diabetes research, to the leaps and bounds they have made in cancer discoveries. It would be extremely ill-informed to break off this stream of collaboration between Technion and Ken Cornell. While these advantageous types of relationships are being targeted, the university receives over $3 billion in foreign funding, with sources in Qatar granting Cornell the most financial gifts. Additionally, the university has a campus in Qatar, the Weill Cornell Medicine at Qatar. Qatar has funneled over $1.8 billion to Hamas, killed thousands of migrant workers, and has very little consideration for the rights of women and the LGBTQ+ community. Why does Qatar and its very well-documented history of human rights—
Point of order. I would ask that the chair please enforce the right of all speakers to speak and eject those who are not allowing it.
Why does Qatar and its very well-documented history of human rights abuses pass the litmus test of what's acceptable on campus, but Technion doesn't? This is clearly not about defending human rights, but about delegitimizing Israel for the sake of it. I would therefore implore you to vote against Resolution 61 and preserve opportunities for me and students like me. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Veronica Ma, and I'm a sophomore in the College of Arts and Sciences. I'm here to speak in support of Resolution 55. Last year, during the Pathways to Peace event, Miss Livni, a former Israeli foreign minister, was invited. In 2016, Livni was summoned by the UK police. According to BBC News, quote, "The questioning was to have been about suspected war crimes and violations of the Geneva Conventions during the 2008 to 2009 Operation Cast Lead in Gaza." Amnesty International states that during the 22 days of Operation Cast Lead, densely populated civilian areas were struck. Amnesty International delegates found that the destruction was wanton and deliberate and could not be justified on grounds of military necessity. Ambulances and medical crews were targeted as they attempted to aid the wounded and recover dead bodies. In total, some 1,400 Palestinians were killed. This includes 300 children and hundreds of unarmed civilians. Let me be clear, Miss Livni, a woman who played a crucial role in murdering thousands of innocent civilians, was invited to Cornell's campus for an event called Pathways to Peace. The university statement reads that the people they invited shared their, quote, "unique insight for achieving a peaceful future," unquote. Let me ask you, how can a woman who is a leading force in murdering thousands of innocent people provide insight for achieving a peaceful future when she has been the architect of violence and destruction? I, like all other students present, value academic freedom and the ability to engage in thoughtful debate. We can debate how to have peace in the Middle East. In fact, I encourage these debates. But these debates cannot occur when we have people in the room who have actively destabilized the region and have been suspected to violate the Geneva Convention. When we start to devalue certain lives, in this instance, Palestinian lives, we veer away from the realm of academic freedom. No Cornellian deserves to feel unsafe on this campus. No Cornellian should watch as the value of their life or their people's lives is debated. In every conversation, we must hold ourselves and this university to a certain moral standard that all human lives are worth protecting. Thank you.
How you guys doing tonight? I would just like to say that I don't have much to say specifically about Israel.